Welcome to the Sons of Mjolnir podcast.
The Sons of... what?
This isn't your Sons of Macaroni, yeah!
The Sons of Mjolnir?
This is Sons of Mjolnir, yeah!
Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Sons of Mjolnir. As always, I am one of your hosts, Fat Thor. And today, unfortunately, Gorgon and Cap are not going to be able to make it. But in their place, I am joined by two very, very special guests. You may know them as author and artist of books such as Breath of Shadows, Sea of Sorrows, Road of Bones, and then most recently, Drive Like Hell. Welcome to the show, Alex Cormick and Rich Duick. Guys, thank you so much for coming on to the show and nerding out with me today.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Of course, Yeah, I'm doing good. And like I said, I'm super excited to have you guys on. We just met today, but I was lucky enough to read the first issue of Drives Like Hell. And full spoiler alert for everyone out there, I loved it. It was absolutely awesome. It was like an adrenaline ride. There was some creepy, like, mystery stuff in there. Like, after I read it, I was like, okay, I'm fully on board. I want to know everything about this. I want to know where this is going. So, like I said, I really loved it, and I'm super excited to talk about it with you guys today.
Oh, that's really good to hear, man. I'm excited. So, I was just gonna say, like, I'm excited to hear that because it is like very, very different than the last three projects Alex and I did together. So it's good to hear that it landed with you. So
yeah, absolutely. And I actually want to ask you about that a little bit later. We'll get into that with your other projects. But to start off with, so usually on the show, we usually kind of do, you know, their comic origin story, right? And I know that's a question that you guys probably get a lot and you guys have answered a lot. So for this episode and this time, I kind of want to switch it up a little bit. So Rich, you have talked about that you kind of grew up with comics. You know, were picking up comics at 7-Eleven. Shout out Mike's Comic Hut in Queens, where you, you know, go play some video games and get your comic stories in. But I want to ask you, instead of your comic origin necessarily, I want to ask you about your horror origin. Because obviously your guys' books are very much horror driven. The horror vein is very much alive in your guys' work. So I'm curious of what were some of your early like horror, either movie or stories. I know that you've mentioned John Carpenter a lot. You've mentioned Lock and Key and Scott Snyder's Witches as very big inspirations for you. So can you remember kind of what was the first thing that was like, oh yeah, I love this. Like, I'm in on this.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's like mostly like through movies and stuff, because I used to love staying up late at night watching horror movies that all my parents didn't want me to watch. Mm-hmm. And they would come on HBO and stuff. Some of the earlier ones I remember, like Return of the Living Dead, Nightmare on Elm Street, all the Friday the 13th movies. Mm-hmm. Probably the one that really like stuck with me as like something that where like I saw it and I was like, wow, there's a lot more to horror than just like, you know, like is like this like slasher gonna like, you know, mutilate a co-ed or something like that. Mm-hmm. This movie called Prince of Darkness. That it was just like really like trippy because it had like all like the kind of like the monster stuff, but there was also all this stuff about like, you know, theology, like, you know, God and the devil and mm-hmm. all this stuff. So I think that was probably the first movie that kind of sparked in me that like horror, like there's a lot to horror and a lot deeper stuff going on there.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of like writing, it's actually really funny because I've been like a fan of horror for a long time, but I never in like, if you had asked me like 5-6 years ago, are you ever going to write a horror story? I would have been like, no, never. Not really. I don't think I'd be good at it.
Yeah. And now you got like 10 of them.
It was just that when I was thinking about Road of Bones, like I was originally kind of thinking it for wanting to do like a Prison Break story, and I was thinking like, oh, maybe it'll be sci-fi, maybe it'll be fantasy or something, because that was like my wheelhouse. But just the more that I read it, the more I was like, you know, like, I think this is a horror story, and I think I think I'm gonna give it a try. And lucky for me, Alex saw the potential there too. So
I would say, well, it seemed to work out for you, because like I said, you got about 10 horror books now, and they've all been really good. All have been, you know, received very well as also. And then Alex, I mean, kind of similar question to Rich, you know, horror origin story. You talked about how you would get hand-me-down comics from your older brother. You mentioned Kraven's Last Hunt as one of your first books, which I thought was like very fitting for your kind of, you know, horror dark style that you're into now. But and I also saw that you mentioned, you know, The Thing, which I definitely can see influence in your work, and Alien. So again, similar question. Can you remember like one particular thing that really like just kind of opened you up to that?
Yeah. So it's funny with because with horror stuff, like I didn't see many movies or anything like that when I was a kid. Like I remember like being in like middle school and seeing like Carrie, and the whole hand coming out of the thing scared the hell out of me. Like, that was one of like, you know, I'm like, I don't know if this is for me. I mean, like I had like, I went up to my room and I had to like pace for a while. Like, all right, it's okay. You know, it's all right.
I'm okay. I'm okay. So again, but, very fitting for the book that you guys are writing now.
But so the thing is like a lot of that stuff, like, when I was kind of getting curious about it, it was like Scream had just come out. And then it was like a lot of like kind of teeny bopper. Like I Know You Did Last Summer. Like I, and the Faculty, and I like these movies. But at the time, like my younger sister was really into them. And I was like, and it was like that age difference where like, she's only a year younger. And I was just like, ah, that's not for like, it's not for me. I don't know. It's kind of like for like, you know, like it just, I was like, I don't know.
That's for kids.
Yeah, it's for kids. Whatever. It's all like, need, like 17 magazine with like a little bit of blood. Ooh, whoop de doo.
Yeah.
And, but she actually started getting really into it. And my brother was always into it. So he was showing her a bunch of stuff. And it wasn't until she had Night of the Living Dead on. And I was like, oh, I've, you know, this is one you've always heard of. And, and it was just always like in the zeitgeist type of thing. And I think I walked in at the ending. And the fact that he got shot at the end, and I was just like, oh, that's actually really good. That's really clever. And oh, wow. And they, and I was thinking like the history of it and where it was in time, and the fact that it was a movie that like creates and all this type of stuff. And I was like, oh, there's more to this than just blah, you know?
Yeah.
And I was like, all right. That's so I saw that, and that kind of snowballed into, all right, well, what's this one? And what's this one? And then my brother and I, because yeah, once my sister saw Texas Chainsaw Massacre, she's like, "No, I think I'm good. I like that.
I'm out. I'm done.
I'm gonna go back to like watching, you know, like comedies and having fun with that." But so then my brother grabbed me, and we started getting together, like especially in October, and we would get together every week, and we would do a double feature of horror movies, and specifically ones we never seen. So we basically developed our like a whole thing with this, just from like getting together and watching, like, have you heard of this? I kind of heard of this, or like you know, I saw like a part of this way back when I was a kid. I don't really remember, but let's chuck it on. And so yeah, so my whole introduction of horror really started like at like the end of high school, college age.
Yeah, and just kind of snowballed and snowballed.
Yeah, so and then I jumped right in and like, all right, let's study this and like really, you know,
yeah,
down and dirty, roll around, you know?
Yeah, let me draw this. Let me draw all this crazy, scary stuff I'm seeing. So,
and that bit right there really came from watching Dead Alive, Grindhouse, and Invincible. And I've said this before, but there's a shot where in the Voldemort Wars, because I jumped in late, where somebody's getting their hand shoved through the stomach and like all his guts and blood and stuff's puking out of the back. And I remember thinking like, oh my God, you could do this in a comic book?
Like, that's and possible?
Jeez. Like I was like, I always thought it was like, you know, said this before, but like Wolverine, like he's got the knives, he'll slash you, but nothing happens. He's just getting over it. You know, I get a little cut, but not really.
Yeah. You're so like, oh my God. Like,
oh, you can really cut loose in this, and this is great. And all right, this is what I'm doing now.
Hell yeah, that's awesome. We're huge fans of the Book of Mark over here. We love Invincible. So to know that inspired you, that's super funny and that's super cool.
Oh, a huge influence on me.
Oh yeah, and we love Otley too. He's the man. I was lucky enough to meet him at Comic-Con, and like the nicest dude ever. So nice. But back to you, Rich. I got another question for you. So you kind of led into it perfectly with your answer. We're on the same mindscape right now. But you were saying how, you know, you never really thought of yourself writing horror. And you, like I said, you've mentioned that you always wanted to be a writer. You wrote short stories. You even at one point wanted to write a novel. So what were those kind of stories? And not only what were those kind of stories, but when you decided, okay, I want to try my hand at this, what was, I guess, kind of the voice you wanted to bring to the medium?
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, when I was first started like writing and trying stuff, I really lent myself more to like science fiction and fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
I think part of that was because I grew up like another one of my nerdy hobbies was like playing like D&D and stuff like that. And I really loved the kind of like world building aspect of it. Like, you know, if I was writing a fantasy story, like, I might have trouble writing the story, but like I could fill like a notebook just talking about like the history of the city and all the different factions and like, you know,
mm-hmm. the lore. Stuff.
Yeah. All the lore that mm-hmm. like might or might not make it into, you know, into the actual story. So I really love that aspect of it. And I think the thing that kind of like, well, I never really thought of myself as like a horror writer was because like when I would look at most horror, like I think most of it takes place like in the real world, you know, like mm-hmm. in like, you know, some kind of like darker version of reality. And for me, like, I think at the time, even though I've learned you can go pretty far with it, like, it didn't seem to me as like exciting to try and build out like some kind of like mythology or lore.
Mm-hmm.
Having it like so closely tied to the real world. But I think what I realized with writing Road of Bones is that like you can do a lot, you know, like you really can, like once you kind of decide on what aspect of horror you're going to bring to reality, like you can do a lot of world building and a lot of lore writing as far as like what the monster is or if there's a monster or like what exactly is going on here that is making everything this like dark deviation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the things I really fell in love with as far as writing horror that started with Road of Bones and continued Sea of Sorrows and Breath of Shadows is I thought it was like, I find it's a really good genre for talking about like the human condition, you know, mm-hmm. like, you know, it's one of those things where like we live in like a pretty crazy world, you know, like there's a lot of like fucked up shit that goes on all the mm-hmm. time. And just the mere fact of like existence, and not to get like too deep or weird, but it's like, just like some of the things about like, we're like on this planet and like, you know, like we live our lives and then we die and that's really fucked up, you know,
mm-hmm.
and just kind of like psychology and all this stuff is going through my head. And it's like, I think horror is like a really great way to kind of address some of that stuff or talk about it or ask questions about it without kind of sounding like you're, or without like sounding like a nut job or like boring or something like that. Because it's like, if you just kind of like talk about it straight out, it's like you could, might as well just, or at least, you know, you might as well just be like some like guy like ranting on the corner, like holding a sign or something, you know?
Yeah.
Make the Lord very nervous.
All right.
I'm burning now.
Take it easy.
Hellfire is burning me.
But it's like, if you can wrap it in like a horror story, it's like you can explore a lot of that stuff without, without feeling like you're kind of doing it in some like inexplicable way that like only you and voices in your head understand.
Yeah, so instead of just like you said going on the street corner, put it in a comic book and then it'll all make sense. But I really love that, and I think that, you know, I really love that kind of outlook on it, because I mean, fear is one of the most primal kind of feelings or emotions you can experience. And I mean, I think everyone shows their true self when they're afraid. So I think, like you said, exploring the kind of nuances of the human condition through horror, that's also what makes things scary. If, you know, we can relate to that, it's like you said, exploring these feelings and emotions that all of us have. So that's, I love that. That's really, really awesome. Alex, so going back, before we get into Drive Like Hell, and also I want to say, dude, deep weird conversation, that we live for that here, baby. Let's get weird, man. Let's get deep. We love it. We love that stuff. So never hold back. But Alex, just really quickly before we start talking about Drive Like Hell, because like I said, I really love this book and I want to get into this for as much time as we can. But going back to kind of your you know, starting off with comics and horror and everything, one thing I was very interested about is, so you kind of started in animation, and you talked about how you made a Christmas cartoon with your wife, and that really kind of opened your eyes to, you know, putting a story together, and that you really loved like visually putting together these stories. So I was curious, what, I'm sure there's a lot of things, but what was like probably the biggest thing that you took from animation that you still use to this day in your work? I know I've heard that you're pretty fast with the pen and that you can turn out a page pretty damn quickly. So was that something that you learned from your days in animation?
Yeah, with animation, especially doing it just you know, like, so I mean, that's the thing. So that Christmas cartoon, South Pole, it's on YouTube.
I'm watching it right when we get off.
You
want to
catch some jokes that don't land. I mean, just doing it by myself, and you got to learn how to draw fast, especially with animation. You got to be, especially when you're drawing it 2D animation, you learn to be quick, you know? Things that I learned from it, I mean, you know, turn around for a character, because animation, you got to know what every angle, top, bottom, left, right, you know, what they all look like. So you got to get used to that. You got to know, basically, you kind of have to get used to drawing anything. So for example, right now, cars. And you got to figure out, if you can't draw it, you better figure out ways to be able to draw it. And luckily, you know, it's 2023, you know, we got Google Images, we got Google whatever, you know. And even if that doesn't work, well, I guess like for a car, that's why you can go to the toy store and buy some Matchbox cars and use those. And you know, if you can't get a pose right, guess what? Get up, use a camera, take a picture, and now you got the pose. And it was like stuff with that, doing animation too. Like if you had a monologue, you had to get up and this guy had to be acting it out. So you'd get up and act it out and be that character for a minute, like do the lines in your head and like, videotape yourself doing it. Like, okay, these are some mannerisms. All right, I get that. So it's not just lips going up and down.
Yeah.
I mean, like you said, it was after doing it, and it really was the storyboard stuff that I was having the most fun with. And I was looking at comic books while doing it, because there was a big fight scene between Santa Claus and his brother, and I was just winging it at first. I'm like, this is not working. I'm like, this is just not like, it's just, so I sat down and like, all right, I got a zillion comic books. Let's flip through them and get some ideas. And and then it started just like, oh yeah, this all makes sense. And like, do a shot like this and like this. And that was the most fun of that entire project. And so then I was like, all right, maybe there's something to this like sequential storytelling. And that kind of just evolved into doing what I'm doing now. But the page I'm working on, that Rich, you haven't seen yet. I started it.
Oh, exclusive.
But like, there's like this, I'm doing like trying to follow this whole thing in there. And, but like, I'm trying to make it like, all right, if you animate this, will it work as an animation, like turn into a GIF or whatever? But yeah. I'm still using these little tricks and like squash and stretch and all that type of stuff. And
it's funny because when we were doing the working through like the creature design for Sea of Sorrows, like the Siren, she kind of has this not to spoil it for anybody, but this kind of secondary mouth that kind of opens up. And Alex did this like, he was just like, what do you think of this? And he sent this like GIF animation, and it was like the coolest thing I've ever seen. It was like the picture that he drew for the main design, and it was like, rawr! Like it just like opened up, closed, opened up, closed.
Oh, that's and so cool.
Like, it was so cool. I wish we could have like kind of captured that, like, and put it in the book somehow, because it was just
I'm trying to think of what happened to that. It's probably in a file somewhere.
Say, now we got to figure out a way to put GIFs onto the page, because I want to see that now. That's got to be super cool, though, being able to not only draw whatever's in your head, but then also be able to basically bring it to life, right? Like, that's super cool.
Yeah, it's fine.
Like, yeah, I'm gonna make a GIF out of this freaking crazy creature I just made. I also got to say, you were talking about, you know, taking pictures and like, you know, reference shots. I don't know if I'd want to look through your Google image search, my man, because I can only imagine some of the stuff I've seen you draw. I can only imagine some of them references.
Once Breath of Shadows wrapped up, it's been a lot cleaner.
Yeah.
There's so many bugs. Like, YouTube has stopped like offering like, hey, you want to see more videos about centipedes?
Yeah. No, I really don't. Alex like weird bugs. So after you do animation, so then you get future proof, you start getting some more work done, and then you meet a guy by the name of Rich at New York Comic Con, and it kind of starts this partnership. And like I said, we mentioned before, you guys have done Breath of Shadows. Let's see, Sea of Sorrows, Road of Bones. I think I'm missing one in there as well. But now that brings us to Drive Like Hell, the three letter titles. Yeah. So, like I said, I really, really enjoyed this book. So I got to read the first issue, and it's going to be out of four issues, correct?
Yep, that's right.
Yep. And so this first issue, we follow our main character, Bobby. And basically, it's a car thief who's stealing a car for a bank heist. And turns out this car is owned by the devil. So you can only imagine the kind of hijinks that ensue after that. You guys have described this book as Mad Max Fury Road with demons and angels, but also have thrown out like Blues Brothers and Smokey and the Bandit as references. So for Rich, my first question for you is, for this first issue, something I really, really enjoyed about it and that I really loved, and I think I find that it's kind of a constant in your work, is that you're very, very good at balancing the tones. So like for Drive Like Hell, like we have horror going on, but there's also humor, and there's like the kind of mystery of, you know, the car, and the first couple panels is, you know, kind of sets up a mystery that we still have yet to find out. So my question on that is, when you're writing this, are you conscious of the kind of balance that you're trying to achieve as far as like horror and humor? And like, do you have, I don't know, like a sort of mental checklist, like, oh, there's too much humor, I need to put some horror in there? Or does it just kind of flow naturally as you're writing?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that I do it like super consciously. Like, there is definitely like kind of like a flow to it. But I think it's kind of like, it's a component of like kind of like the pacing, you know what I mean? It's like, I think when you're writing a comic, and when you're making a comic, there, especially a horror comic, a lot of it is about building the mood, because you don't really have a lot of the tools that like, say, like a filmmaker or a novelist might have. Because like, when you're watching a horror movie, you've got camera movement, you've got music, you've got like, you can have something kind of like jump out at you and like give somebody that kind of like adrenaline rush of like, you know, like, oh my God, you know? I think in comics, what I found the way to build horror most effectively is to just sort of like build this mood, build this atmosphere of like, and build this tension. Alex is amazing at doing that in his drawings. But from like the writing perspective, it's like, it's really just about just like sort of like revealing things. And I think if you just sort of stick with one mood for too long, it can get a little like exhausting. It can get a little exhausting to read. Mm-hmm. It can get a little exhausting to write too. So it's like, you sort of like switching to humor is something that helps kind of like release the tension in the same way that like a jump scare might release the tension in a movie. Like if you think of like the classic movie scene where like somebody's in a haunted house or somebody's in a house and they hear a noise and they go, and it's really fucking tense because it's a noise, and we, the audience, know that, you know, there's a killer that just escaped from prison and he's, you know, roaming the neighborhood, and like you hear like rattling and all this stuff, and then like it's tense. And then they get there and oh, it was just the cat coming in through the window. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That diffuses the tension, and then you get to like build it up again. And the kind of like building the tension and diffusing it and building it and diffusing it is what gives the story like its pacing and its rhythm. So like in comics, like if you were to take the same scene and it's like, oh, it's the cat, you know, it's like you can do it, but I don't think it's as effective as it is in film, because you don't have like the same kind of like tools of like, you know, like movement and things like that. So I think like switching up the tone to something humorous is a really good way to kind of get that same effect of like, you know, dissipating the immediate tension and starting the clock over to like build some more tension. And then just every time you build it a little more and you build it a little more, you release it, you build it a little more. And then, you know, you kind of like, you know, come to the climax where it's like, okay, well now the actual threat is here. And, you know, we're gonna, you know, deal with it. But like I said, I don't know, like, I don't like plan it out beforehand. I just sort of go with like how I'm feeling as I'm writing it. Because like a lot of times when I'm writing, I'll sort of play it out in my head a little bit. One of the things I like to do, not every time, but a lot of times, if I'm writing a scene, I'll kind of have the dialogue in my head like as I'm typing, but I won't type out the dialogue. I'll just sort of type out what's happening and hear the conversations kind of playing out in my head. And then I'll go back over it and I'll start putting the dialogue in based on that. And then as I'm putting the dialogue in, I might like wind up changing something in the panel descriptions or things like that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's like, it's definitely like a mix of just like, I wouldn't call it like improvisation, but it's definitely like the kind of thing that I get a feel for like as I'm writing. It's not so much something that I like say like, and I'm like, okay, 3 pages of horror, then we'll make a joke, then we're gonna do 4 pages. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah, so it's more like jazz than an equation.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that. And I mean, just like you, the kind of insight on, you know, how you kind of structure these stories, that's just super, super interesting. And I think, you know, you kind of hit it on the head. Tension is really what grabs us in the movies. And like you said, in a book, obviously, I mean, the score of a horror movie, that's like the most important thing. You guys are both John Carpenter fans, so I'm sure you've heard this story about how he showed the original Halloween for the first time without any music, and people were like, wow, this sucks, dude, like what are you showing me right now? And then they added the music and then everyone's, you know, shitting their bridges. So I can only imagine, like I said, the way that you describe, you know, building that tension without those tools at your disposal, that's just so, so interesting. I could listen to you talk about that all day. But Alex, kind of going off of that as well, same kind of similar thing with the structure. So you've talked about how you usually structure the panels yourself, which I mean, I'm sure there's some collaboration with that on certain things, but I found that the panels in this were very creative, and especially during like the car chasing scenes, there were just some choices where I was like, man, that's really smart. Like, I haven't seen that before. Cool. So just kind of similar question. I'm just curious for, you know, someone who doesn't know much about art or stuff like that, how do you go about structuring the panels? And like, so Rich sends you the script, I'm sure in the yep. script it has like, okay, you know, car chase.
Yeah, like panel one, panel two, panel, like panel one, like let's say like he gets in the car, panel two, he peels out, panel three, he looks behind him, and yeah. So yeah, it's basically just reading it out and just seeing what's and just trying to make it interesting, you know, because it's like you know, I, you know, growing up in the 90s and looking at like, you know, Tom McFarlane and Jim Lee and all and Rob Liefeld, all those guys, and their panels were all like, it was never just boom, 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 boom. It was always, here's a long panel, here's this mm-hmm. thing, here's that thing, here's a circle, like same, like the Max, it's like, here's a shape that's like, it doesn't even mean, what does it mean? Does it mean anything?
Yeah.
Who cares? It's cool. Go with it. Yeah. And so, yeah, so I had that in my head, like when I was doing these, and on top of that, before getting really into comics, like I always thought I was going to be a comic, but for like newspapers illustrator, like my growing up, my heroes were like Bill Watterson and Gary Larson and Jim Davis and Charles Schultz and guys like that. But I always loved how Bill Watterson did his Sunday strips, especially where he could just go bananas with it. And like have a little box here, big box there, and just kind of, you know what I mean? Like, and so I had it in my head, like, well, if I'm going to be doing this, that's the type of stuff I want to do, kind of show off what I can do with like just the pacing while looking at these boxes, just knowing that, all right, you start at the top and you kind of do this like a Z, you go there, down there, there, and then you're out. And so what can you do while following this? Can you surprise them with little things in here? Even though you see everything right up front and that type of stuff. And it's just playing with it and having fun, you know, yeah. But it's always to serve the story, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like I'm not just doing it just, you know, like stroke my own ego or anything like that. It's more like, all right, does this make sense? This is like, this is a big reveal. So let's make that, let's show that off, you know, and like, don't tuck it into like a little like, you know, insert panel in the bottom where like, oh, that's a killer. Oh, yeah, chuck it down there. Like, yeah. I kind of really show that off. Kind of feel, kind of figure out like which like the page, like which is the, what's this one page really, what's it saying here, and really try to show that off as much as I can. And know that I got to do it in the five or six or four panels that Rich is like, ah, there it is.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's crazy. I mean, that's why, you know, that's why you're the artist and I just talk about stuff, because I can only imagine like how you even start to approach that. And the other thing that really impressed me with, like I said, the paneling was not only was it creative, but it also was easy to read as well. I feel like I've also
really nice to hear.
Yeah, because I've also had the experience where I'm like, okay, this is cool paneling, but like, wait, I read this one. I should have read this one first. And what? But yours flew very nicely. There wasn't a time where I was like, wait, I think I read this panel instead of this panel. So really, really impressive how you're able to, like I said, both you flex that creative muscle and, you know, make something new and interesting, but also it still be easy to read and not, you know, harder on the reader.
Thank you. Yeah. And a lot of that has to go to our letterer Haas.
Yeah. I was just going to say, I was just going to call him out. Yeah.
If I don't do my work, he'll be like, I got it. Boom, boom, boom.
Yeah.
Now you can read it.
He picks up the slack in the group.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
But that reminds me of something I wanted to ask about specifically, and this might be a question for him. Unfortunately, he's not here, but I don't think this is a spoiler. If it is, let me know and I'll, you know, edit this out. But there's a page in the book where the word bubbles are coming out of someone's head. And I was like, that is awesome. That is so freaking cool. So was that your decision, or was that the?
Oh, that was him.
Yeah. That was him.
Oh, that was Haas. That's all Haas. Yeah.
Yeah. Originally, I had like that character smoking a cigarette, and it's the smoke was coming in the back, But he took it a step further, which made it even better having the speech bubble.
Yeah, like you said, I first noticed the smoke, and then the next page I saw the bubble coming out. I was like, oh, that's good. I was like, that's good.
Oh, yeah.
I had to bring that up because I think that was probably one of my favorite. I mean, there's a lot of great panels in this first issue, but that one I was like, I like that. So, Rich, kind of, again, going a little bit off of the kind of structure of the book and, like, you know, how you tell a story, I was interested, too, like we talked about. So you're balancing a couple tones here, like we said, horror, humor, you got a little mystery going on as well. And I'm curious, when you're writing a book like this, something that has this kind of mystery that you're unfolding throughout the issues, obviously I'm assuming that you have the whole thing, like, kind of blueprint at least laid out in your head. But how do you decide how much to give away each issue? So, like, in issue one, we get, you know, the first two couple panels are, you know, kind of a little tease, and then there's stuff, you know, kind of breadcrumbs throughout, if you would. So I'm just curious, when you're writing, like, how do you decide, okay, this is just enough to lead us into two, or, you know, this is too much, I need to save this for issue three? How does that work?
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, honestly, it's not like a hard and fast thing. It's kind of like, it all comes down to, like, my best guess as to, like, what's going to get you as a reader to come to want to come back for more. Mm-hmm. You know, like, it's got to be enough that you read it and be like, oh fuck, I want to know what happens next, you know. Mm-hmm. Or like, I really want to see what the story is with this guy here. But you don't want to kind of give it away too much, because then it's like, if you give too much, then it's like, oh, like, I get this. Like, I don't really need to come back and see what's going on. So there's always going to be this, like, weird balance. But I think, like, in the first issue, like, there's like a few things you need to establish. You kind of need to establish, like, what's going on, like, who's involved, you know, and maybe just, like, sort of like a hint as to why. Mm-hmm. And then as you go on in the subsequent issues, you reveal a little bit more of the why. And then, like, I think in, like, a four issue structure, like, pretty much, I think at the end or towards the end of issue three is when you kind of, like, reveal, like, most of it. And then mm-hmm. issue four is kind of, like, about dealing with that, the consequences of that revelation, you know?
Yeah.
So I think, like, it's like, if you break it down into, like, three act structure, it's like, you know, kind of like, the end of act two is when you're going to have, like, the mystery revealed, or at least what you think the mystery is. It's going to be, like, fully out in the open. And then act three is a lot of, like, kind of, like, dealing with the consequences of it being out in the open. And then there might be a twist at the end of act three that means, like, oh, what you thought the solution was the mystery is not actually the mystery, but, like, there's room for that to happen. But it's like, I think by the midpoint of the story, by, like, issue three, issue four, it's like, you really want to kind of have asked all the questions and start, and that's when you're going to be starting to answer them.
Mm-hmm. So this book is four issues. Does the run of the issues ever affect that story, or, like, that mystery you're setting up? Because say you had eight issues, does that, or do you base the issues on the story? Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. It totally does affect it. I mean, if we had eight issues, I think you can, like, you can tease things out a little bit more. You can make them a little more complicated in the fact of, like, you can add more twists and turns. Like, you know, if you think of, like, a like a horror movie, you know, it's like, it's not, they don't necessarily have to be straightforward, but it's like, there's very much like, usually like a single plot line you're kind of following. If you're looking at like a horror TV show, you could have as many as three or four plot lines going on at the same time. And like, you know, one episode will concentrate on one and you might only get a little bit of the other one. And then the next episode might switch it up, you know? So the more room you have, I think the more kind of plot lines and threads you can weave. And the skill in doing that is doing that without it getting like super confusing.
Yeah.
But, you know, cause it's like, you would think like more room is good, but then it's like, if you have too much room, things can start to meander. So it's like, you really kind of want to find the right length for the story that you want to tell. Mm-hmm. And like, I think when we originally pitched Drive Like Hell, we were thinking like 5 issues. Cause, I think we're really comfortable in that space. CSRs is 5 issues. Breath of Shadows is 5 issues. So just like the pacing kind of felt right. But when Dark Horse was like, how, like, would it be possible to do it in 4 issues that are like slightly longer? So like, you know, normally a lot of comics, they are like 20 pages or 22 pages of story. Every issue of Drive Like Hell is 24 pages of story. So really what that meant was like at the end of the day, kind of trimming down about 10 or 11 pages. So, you know, it does have an effect, but it was just sort of like a question of like, okay, well, where can we kind of like, where can we trim the fat? You know, it's like, you want to look at the different scenes and plot points that you have and things, and like which ones are essential and which ones are nice to have. And then the ones that are nice to have are the ones that you're probably going to tend to cut first.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there's a bunch of stuff that you would love to add into the book, but like you said, I think at the end of the day, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's about keeping the intent and the like the vein of the story. And it's like, yeah, it's great to have this extra stuff, but if it's not directly serving that, then, you know, like you said, cuts have to be made sometimes.
Yeah, you know, it's like that old saying, like kill your darlings, you know, like one interpretation of that is it's like you might love a scene to death, but it's gotta go, unfortunately. Yeah.
Well, you were talking earlier that, you know, you're real big into lore and all that stuff. So maybe you could just make a comic with all the stuff that didn't make it. Do a Drive Like Hell issue 5, and it's just all the extras, director's cut.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, you never know. It's like, I mean, if comics do well, it's like we can always, you know, come back for like a sequel. It's like, you know.
Fingers crossed. Everyone, you listen to this right now, go to your comic shop right now. Pick up some damn books. Alex, I wanted to ask you, we were talking a little bit about this already, and Rich, you kind of talked about this in the writing aspect of it, but I'm curious of the visual aspect of it. So we kind of talked about this a little bit before we started recording, and something I really love about your work, and I think that you do really, really, really well, is your use of light and shading, and like your use of like using the light as a focal point of a scene. And also, I've noticed you really love your smoky kind of atmospheres, and like I really love that, and I think it really works to like pull you into the story. So I'm curious, again, kind of going back to your process a little bit, when you're working on like a layout of the scene, what is like most important for you when you're trying to establish that tone and the kind of, like I said, the emotion that you're supposed to be feeling in that scene?
Yeah, as far as layouts, it's always like, and layouts, I'll sketch it out on just pencil and paper, that type of thing, even though the final thing is drawn digitally and colored digitally and all that, but I'll sketch it all out by hand and just kind of have it like in my hand so I can actually look at it. But at that point, it's all just about like telling the story and making sure it all, and like the stuff I was saying before, you know, it's just a matter of like all right, what are you trying to say on this page? Are you saying it or not? Right.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as the lighting and a lot of time, I think goes, then you get into it and you're like, all right, what's going on in the scene? Like, you know, basic stuff, like what time of day is it? What kind of place is it? Is mm-hmm. this a place where feel safe? If it is, it's probably well lit. If it's, you know, you probably could get robbed here or your car stolen out of the driveway, it's probably gonna be dark and a little mysterious. And, you know, I mean, if the devil's hanging out this place or his goons are hanging out this place, it's probably not gonna be the best, you know, yeah. You're probably not to bring the kids here, you know? So you probably get it. And but a lot of it also, like, I love noir stuff, you know, mm-hmm. and you know, it's like you watch old noir movies, and especially working in black and white, I mean, just what they could do with the shadows is because they're working on a budget, you know. It's like the whole Venetian blind shadow on the wall or anything like that was based on, hey, we don't have any artwork to put on the wall. I don't know. We'll just put a flashlight behind the blinds and that'll do it. It's something on the wall. Like, all right, go film it.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of techniques that those guys did, it's just visually just great. So I'll, you know, steal from there, steal from that, steal from other black and white photography and all that. And, but then that's just a black and white spot. Then once you get the color, that's when it's really putting the final touches on something.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when a lot of it really comes to life. And you know, like in like some scenes like that, you can add some red in there, make it a little more like, make it a little nervous. And also being a fan of like Basil Gogo's or like, you know, like Dario Argento, like watching Suspiria and stuff like that. So you want to like, let's have some fun with some colors. Does that fit the scene? Does it not fit the mm-hmm. scene? And all that type of stuff. And it's just, and the nice thing with working digitally, you can experiment super easy. And it's not like if I was doing it traditional, even though I was doing something like watercolor or painting or something like that, like, oh, let's try this. That doesn't work. Well, shoot. All right. Yeah, exactly. I'll see in a couple hours. But here I'd be like, okay, this looks, let's try red. Red doesn't work. So I will do click, click. Let's mm-hmm. try that. There it is. Okay. And let's just up this a little bit. And all right, let's redo it. None of that works. Sorry, scrap it. But
mm-hmm.
you're not like killing time as far as like moving fast. I mean, that's huge, you know?
Yeah, I can only imagine. I mean, those guys back at Ditko and those dudes back in the day
right?
Struggling.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you know, the Control Z saved my life, you know? Yes, sir. Hey.
Hey.
All right, you got to go to bed, Mr.
That's the real artist, huh?
Yeah, there it is. This is the brain. That's
the ghost artist.
That's right. Right? You really draw all my comics, right? Yeah.
What I was going to get into, Rich, with, I mean, this is kind of a question for both you guys, but we can, you know, start it off real quick. So we talked about this a little bit at the very beginning, and you guys have mentioned that your previous works, Road of Bones, Sea of Sorrow. So I kept wanting to say Sea of Thieves for some reason, which I know that's not it. Sea of Sorrows and Breath of Shadows. You kind of talked that those were kind of almost a trilogy, not in the sense of like the characters crossover or anything, but like thematically. And you've also mentioned that those have to, like, a common theme in those books was post-war trauma. So I'm curious, and you mentioned that this book is different from your other books. So I'm curious, does this fit into that kind of trill, or I guess a saga now? And if so, how does Drive Like Hell fit into your other works?
Yeah, I don't know that it so much fits with the other ones. I mean, it does. It does kind of
weird cousin, right?
Yeah, it's like a weird cousin. It does. It's like the thing it has most in common is it does take place in kind of like a bygone era. You know, like I think, like Drive Like Hell takes place like in this kind of like weird fantasy 70s kind of. I think the reason we picked that was just because a lot of the cultural stuff and the movies that we were drawing on came out in that era. Like, you know, like you said, Smokey and the Bandit, Blues Brothers, you know, like late 70s, early 80s, mm-hmm. Cannonball Run. Like, you know, these are all kind of like pretty old movies, but they're like, I think, like a lot of fun. And I think that's kind of what Drive Like Hell has that those the other books don't, is that it's not that the other books aren't fun, it's just sort of like a different kind of fun. Like Drive Like Hell just really wears its fun on its sleeve. Like it's just like, it's a fun, it was fun to write. Alex, I hope it was fun to draw. And it's, you know, like even like reading it now, like every time I look at the comps of like the issues and stuff, like when I'm, you know, just like looking at the lettering and just seeing if we're going to make any notes, I have a lot of fun reading it. And it's not that we skimp on horror, and it's not that we skimp on stuff like that. It's just that it's just like, it's a different vein that we're kind of mining here.
Mm-hmm. So you'd say that the first three, those would be brother sisters. This is, like you said, cousin.
Yeah.
This
yeah.
Like rockabilly cousin. Yeah. Coming okay.
And, Alex, I mean, do you just, I just curious, do you have anything to add on to that? Like, as far as visually, do you find like a kind of through line between these books?
Yeah. You know, it's, I mean, they look similar because it's me drawing them, but
or you know, is it?
Yeah, what? Yeah,
it's that your assistant.
But I mean, I can see Bobby Ray flipping through the radio and the shades come on, and he could be like, "Next." Or, but yeah, you know, I mean, a lot of stuff. I mean, like everybody else wants to have like connected universe type of thing. So. Mm-hmm. And a lot of stuff I do, I'll like, it'll be like products like it, but it'll be, if they go to like a certain, like a store or something, it'll be named the same store as like a book that I did like a bunch of years ago. Or,
okay.
Or like if they're gonna like Tarantino, like with the Red Apple cigarettes.
I was just about to say that, yeah, like the cigarette, yeah, that's Tarantino. Stuff, you know? Like, I love, so it's not stuff necessarily like that.
Connected, but uh-huh. I'll throw some products in there, you know?
Oh, see, and like, I love stuff like that. See, I'm going to, like I said, I'm going to be doing my homework after I get off of here and, you know, going through your guys' other work. And I'm going to be eagle-eyeing on these Easter eggs, my man, because I, like I said, I love that kind of stuff.
I think the only one I got here, there's I had two friends of mine from high school, and the last name is with Smith and Preventure. And I made that into like a company, and they make like, you know, booze and like all sorts of stuff.
That's awesome.
And I'm sure that's popped up somewhere. I don't know.
That's so cool. Like I said, I really love that stuff. Speaking of your guys' other work, and like I said, this is your most recent book, but I'm sure there's going to be more books in the future between both you guys. So I'm curious. This is actually the first time that we've had a writer and artist on at the same time. So since I have both you guys here, I kind of wanted to ask your guys' opinion. In your guys' opinion, like I said, you guys have worked together for a while now, and obviously it seems like you guys enjoy it because you guys are making some great stuff. So in your guys' opinion, maybe, you know, with your guys' relationship or, you know, relationships you've had in the past, what makes a great artist writer relationship? Because I mean, don't get me wrong. I mean, Alex, you're in a position where you do the colors as well, but we all know, you know, comics is a group effort, the letterers, editors, all that come into play to bring these things to life. The real creative process is really between the writer and the artist. So like I said, in both your guys' opinion, what do you think makes that symbiotic relationship work so well together?
I think, at least from my perspective, like it's that you kind of have to be open to each other and open to like hearing each other's input and giving each other enough space to kind of do the things that they do best. You know, like I think a misconception that I think a lot of writers have when they first start out, I just say that because I see it a lot in the way some of them like talk like publicly about it. There's this kind of idea that like, well, I'm the writer, it's my story, and my artist is just sort of the pair of wrists that's going to illustrate it for me because I can't do it myself. But they're like, you know, they're working for me, and they're, you know, and I am like, you know, going to like crawl up their ass with a microscope to make sure that they're rendering my vision, like, you know, the way that I see it in my head. And I don't think that's the right way to approach it. I think like that road is going to lead, might lead somewhere, but it's not going to lead to like a great artist writer relationship. Mm-hmm. I think for me with Alex specifically, I have such respect and admiration for his skill and his storytelling that I would never want my writing to step on it by telling him what to do or telling him how to, you know, render a page or how to draw something. Like, he might show me something and I might be like, oh, hey, what do you think about this? Or you know, what do you think about, you know, switching this angle? Or what do you think about changing the color of this so it stands out more or something like that? But I'm never going to be like, dude, you have to draw it a certain way because that's what I think is right. Because he's the one drawing it. You know, I'm not drawing. Like, if I could draw it, if I knew what I was doing with, you know, drawing, I would be doing it. I don't. Yeah. So I think it's really just kind of built on this sort of trust that everybody involved with the book is going to be doing their all to make it a great book, you know? Mm-hmm. So I don't need to worry about what Alex is doing, because I know that he wants the book to look amazing. So I know he's going to pour his all his heart and all his skill into it. I trust Hassan's lettering, you know, sometimes just for anybody who's not familiar with the process, you know, we've got lettering balloons. So for some books that have really, really tight production schedules, sometimes they'll do what's called I don't know what they call it, but it's almost like a lettering map. So it's like, you know, Alex might put the page down and then I'll take it and draw where I think the balloon should go, as the writer, just to kind of save letter time. Mm-hmm. I think it happens more commonly in licensed books where you're on a really tight monthly deadline and stuff like that. But I don't need to do that for Haas, because I know that he's an amazing letterer, and anything I tell him to do, flat out tell him to do, is probably going to make things worse. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Once he does it, I could be like, oh, well, can we just make this a little bit smaller? Cause I don't, you know, I feel like it's like a little over, like, you know, like we can talk about stuff, but there's no, there's nothing I can kind of teach him about learning. There's nothing I can teach Alex about drawing. So you know, it's the reason I'm working with them, or the reason I want to work with them and keep working with them. And this goes for Justin too, who lettered our, lettered Rotobone, Ciasaro's, Breath of Shadows. The reason I want to keep working with them is because I love what they bring to the table, and I would never want to be the one to stifle that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, we just said, it's a very collaborative effort. So, you know, I think trusting in those collaborators, that's when, you know, really great art comes about. But Alex, do you have anything to add on to that?
I mean, it's just that. And like Rich was saying, just talking to each other, if I'll come up with an idea and I throw it at Rich, and if he likes it, great. If he doesn't, then great. Okay, fine. You know, it's, we're working together here. You know, if you wanted that kind of control, do your own book, you know, but, it's two things. It helps if it's good, and it helps if they're not a dick. and it works. So.
Yeah. Then Alex is a happy artist. Yeah.
Yep, that's basically what you're gonna do. Yeah. Happy. Yeah.
That's awesome, because like I said, I mean, the artist and writer, that's obviously the essential part of the book, and I think that's a relationship that I feel like it's kind of similar to, you know, actors and stuff. Like, you work with someone a couple times and it's real good, but then, you know, you move on to other projects. So to have like I said, you guys who have worked on multiple projects together, I was just interested to see, like I said, what are your guys' opinion on what makes that a good dynamic?
It definitely happens with actors and directors too. I mean, like if you look at like the Coen brothers, they have actors that they keep returning to because they know that they're going to deliver a great performance. So,
right. Yeah. Or like, isn't that like a new Scorsese movie, which is specifically De Niro and DiCaprio, like the
right.
his two only leads, sure. In the last 30, 40, 50, 100 years, whatever it's been.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's every movie.
Yeah. It happens all the time.
But I mean, hey, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, right? Like you said, you guys, especially in a creative medium, like you said, I think that trust is probably the biggest thing. And I mean, there's a reason that you're a writer and you're an artist. You know what I mean? It's if you can't trust each other to do each other's jobs, then what are we even doing here in the first place? But speaking on working together and kind of feeding off each other, what we were just talking about, I'm curious. So you guys have talked about how sometimes you like to kind of one up each other when you guys are emailing back and forth, and Rich will send you, Alex, something and you're like, oh, that's freaking crazy. But then Rich will say, well, you're the sick one. Like, what do you mean? You just drew it. So I'm curious for kind of both you guys. So for Alex, what's the weirdest or grossest thing that Rich has asked you to draw? And then on the flip side for Rich.
100% of centipedes. centipedes.
Easy, done. You centipedes.
that's it. That's it. We're done. By far.
But for Rich, on the flip side of that, has there been anything that Alex drew that you didn't even ask him to draw and just really took you aback, like, holy shit?
No, it was all stuff I asked him to draw, but he's done it in a way that was like, god damn, yikes. But yeah, it's on my end, it's definitely the centipedes too. It's Breath of Shadow. There's a lot of centipedes coming out of bodily orifices like mouths and ears.
I saw
one of issue one and they're pooping out of his arm. It's
everywhere.
First Alex, page. Panel 3, I think, or panel 4.
Yeah. The one that creates the most disturbing mental image is there's this one panel where Jimmy is looking at one of his bandmates and kind of hallucinating. He's hallucinating centipedes and he kind of sees one crawling out of the guy's eye, kind of underneath his eyeball, poking out of his eyelid. And that one
stays with you to this day.
That one lives in my head sometimes. Yeah.
I'd say, Alex, you said that was the worst and grossest, but you seem to be having a great kick out of it.
I'm laughing now because it's done.
He's like, I put it behind me. I can laugh about it now.
It was one of those, it never got, centipedes are just, but it's one of those once I get into this, it won't be a big deal. Even issue 5, I was like, these guys are gross. And just get them.
The drawing, the centipedes and all that, do you said, it's freaking gross sometimes. Do you ever, when you're drawing, are you ever man, I need to step away for a second. I need to take a break from this. Got a strong stomach?
It's kind of when you're watching a really gory horror movie, it's kind of like, oh, that's gross. Oh my God. But I know those guys are okay. When I'm drawing it, I know it's make believe. And so this happened at the end of Road of Bones. After everything was going on with these guys going through the snow and trudging up mountains and starving to death, the very last thing I drew and we put in the back of the trade was all the characters having a barbecue at poolside. It's sunny day. They got Jimmy Buffett playing in the background. They're having burgers and margaritas and the Domovec's sunning himself, even though he's all black and charred and gross. And it was just one of those, it's now I can, in the book, it didn't necessarily have a happy ending, not all of them, but well, now I can just throw this out there and they live on happily ever after. You know, they're going to go play frisbee or volleyball next or something like that.
Yeah.
So yeah, so it's more my wife put up a thing, like she was hanging out in my office back there as I was wrapping up something. And I was talking to myself when I said this, but apparently she quoted me saying that I kind of sat back and like, yeah, that's pretty gross. I think I'm done. Okay.
All right, put it in the movie. Let's go.
So everyone's just like, can I get this little gross, a little slime here, a little spit there, whatever. Like, it's good. It's good. All right, let's go. Next.
Awesome. I love that. And then, so no, one of my last questions I got for you guys. So horror comics, I feel like, are making not necessarily a big comeback, but very hot right now. And like, there's a lot of really great horror books out there right now. And we kind of already touched on this a little bit when we were talking, when Rich, you were talking about the movies and the kind of how you're playing kind of with different toolboxes. So I'm curious, in your guys' opinion, both narratively and visually, and of course this is subjective, but in your opinion, what makes a great horror story? Rich, I know you talked about the, you know, kind of building tension and, you know, that kind of balance there. But like I said, what do you think really makes us a horror story really connect with people? Like I said, from a story standpoint, and then Alex, for you, from a visual standpoint.
Yeah, I think from a story standpoint, I think what makes the great ones really stand out is when they kind of connect with something universal about people. You know, like usually it's fear, but it could also just be something like, you know, indulging kind of like dark impulses that like we all feel but don't act on. You know, it could be just like a lot of like we talked about, like the trilogy being like having like post-war trauma in common, and you know, just like it's like about the horror of war, that, you know, like hopefully not, we've not maybe not experienced that firsthand, but like we all like know that it's like, you know, it's just like a common human thing. And I think like the story, like you can have like a good horror story that's just like, you know, spooky or gross or gory or whatever. But I think the truly great ones are the ones that do all that, you know, like do like the scares and do like the creeping out and stuff. But then they're also just about kind of just exploring like the shadows of like existence, like, you know, those like deep, dark places that we don't like to think about every day.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Yeah. I love that. Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, Alex.
So I was saying, that was such a good answer. We're all speechless. That was such a great answer.
Follow that, right? Cormac.
All right, Alex. let's see what you got, pal.
Spooky stuff is good.
Scary stuff, cool.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah, it's super duper. I know. It's funny because visually I was like, oh, I'll say no. Let me kind of. So I was contradicting myself in my head, but I mean, a lot of it is, yeah, seeing the stuff that you probably, hopefully, will never see, in a place where you kind of have to deal with it just as in a friendly way, you know, my favorite thing with especially horror comics opposed to a horror movie and anything else like that, or horror video game or horror novel, you know, is that my favorite thing is you kind of have to, you know, there's no, like, you can't rely on a big noise or like the cutting of the film, and like, you know, like especially the blank, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like what you draw, what's in there, you have to like, you got to make sure it works. Otherwise it just doesn't work. You know, mm-hmm. I can't, there's nothing else to rely on for what it is. And you can't even show it quick because hopefully they'll kind of, you got to give your audience a chance to just kind of park and look at like, what's that? Let's look at the sucker. Mm-hmm. And that's my favorite thing about doing it in comics opposed to anything else. Cause you gotta, you know, it's not like H.P. Lovecraft where you can kind of, here's a bunch of like verbs and adjectives and you make it up type of thing. Like, mm-hmm. like some monster, but like, no, you got to show that sucker and you got to make it like, you got to make it as good as you can make it.
Mm-hmm.
And for my sake, at least that's my favorite part about a lot of like drawing horrors. Cause you got no excuse. If it doesn't work, that's my fault. You know, yeah. It's like not even Rich's fault. Like it's because he's like, here, make this. but for visuals, for horror especially, it's just seeing something that you would probably never see, hopefully would never see,
mm-hmm.
in a situation where you don't have to worry about really dealing with it. Like if you see a body that's inside out, well, reading a comic, you don't have to worry about it getting in your shoes, you know. and if you don't like it, sure, flip the page or whatever. Mm-hmm. Or like seeing a monster, seeing like someone who's coming out of the shadows ready to kill you or attack you, or can I trust this person? Like that, like to show that off, to live with that, knowing that if you're uncomfortable, you can turn it off or get rid mm-hmm. of it as fast as you can and be back to a safe spot. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
Rich's was better. I don't know.
Yeah. And I mean, not at all. But I really thought. Like, all right, I'll take the crown on the question.
Yeah, just take it. Take it.
But no, I really love that, though. And like we were talking about with, you know, the movies and all that, I like the kind of idea of, like you said, in movies, there's cuts, there's, you know, shadow, like, oh, the monster doesn't look too great, so we're going to put him behind a bunch of dark shit. But
yeah. That's why the thing is so great, because they were like, no, where the lights are on. Let's look at the sucker.
Yeah, see how ugly it is.
Yeah, I know, like, hey, listen, we spent a lot of time with the clay over there, so let's show that sucker off, you know?
Yeah, and I love that.
Oh, sorry. No,
go, please.
I was just going to say, like you brought up H.P. Lovecraft, that it's like you read those stories and it's like there was an indescribable horror, like new colors that nobody could ever perceive before. And the angles were all wrong. And it's like you can't draw that. It's like, you know, it's like.
Alex, a challenge accepted.
Like Actually, the very act of drawing.
I'll draw my shirt.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that, though. And like I said, here, I could literally sit here and talk to you guys all day about just your writing process and drawing process, because that stuff is so, so fascinating to me. And I mean, I think all of the stuff we talked about is on full display here in this first issue of Drives Like Hell. I cannot wait for the other issues to come. We got three more. This comes out October 17th, if I'm not mistaken, correct?
No, I think.
The 25th, right?
Yeah, I think it's out on the 25th.
The week after, yeah.
Okay, so the 25th, right, and then Halloween. Yeah, right before Halloween, which is absolutely perfect timing. And then final order cutoff, that is going to be on the 17th of this month, right? September?
September, yeah. So that means if you can get in your orders this week, it's a great time to do it. Let your comic shop know that you want it. Helps us out a lot, and it helps them out a lot, because if you don't pre-order it, like, then you are not gonna be kind of like guaranteed that they're gonna have enough copies. You know, they don't want to sell out. We don't, you know, like we'd love for it to sell out, but we also want you all to be able to read it. So.
Yeah, and trust me, guys, you know, all you people out there listening, watching this, you don't want to miss this one. This one is really, really great. Like I said, I can't wait for the other issues. So do not walk, run to your comic book shop, tell them that you want Drive Like Hell, and hell, while you're there, why don't you tell them that you want Sea of Sorrows, not Sea of Thieves, Sea of Sorrows, Breath of Shadows, Road of Bones, and pretty much anything else with these guys' names on it, because I almost guarantee that it's going to be great. Alex, I know that you also have another book coming out on October, also October, I want to say 4th, if I could.
Four, yeah.
Okay, see, I got one right. But Devil That Wears My Face, everyone also go pick that up, because that is also a fantastic book. If you guys trust my opinion about anything, trust me on this one. And to kick this one off and to just kind of put a cap on this, I just want to throw it off to you guys before we get out of here. tell the people where they can find you. We already went through the books that are coming out, but if there's something that I missed, something that people can look forward to, please let them know.
Yeah. So, I mean, the only other thing, like the week after Drive Like Hell comes out, the Breath Shadows will be out in trades. So you'll be able to pick it up that way if you prefer trades to singles. As far as where you can find me, at R Duek, that's Douek, pretty much everywhere. So I'm on Twitter, I'm on, X, Facebook, Instagram, like all those places. But you can find me all of them. You can also find me at my website, rduek.com. Sign up for my newsletter. I send it out semi-regularly. I've been bad this past month, but I'm going to get back into it. If you happen to be in New Jersey, my local store is Eastside Mags. They are always going to have my, stuff like signed there. And I'll kick it over to Alex.
All right. Breath Shadows trade is coming out, and we got some good some extra stuff in there. It's I'm really excited to get out and about for everybody to see. Along with that, along with Drive Like Hell, also like you said, Devil Where's My Face, and also in November I got another book coming out called Ghosts in the Water, from Scout Comics. So keep an eye out for that. But anywhere to find me, Twitter, X, at AlexCormack4, and Facebook and Instagram, which I'm sure will be getting their own letters one of these days soon, will be just my name, Alex Cormack, Alex Cormack Illustrator. I'm around.
It's you're around. Just Google me. Beautiful. Google like. Us, yeah. Guys, I cannot thank you guys enough for coming and nerding out with me today. It's been an absolute pleasure. Like I said, I'm a real big fan of this book, and I can't wait for the people out there to read it as well. Again, I'm going to say it one more time so you don't forget. Go pick up Drive Like Hell. Go tell your comic shop that you want it. And again, guys, I couldn't be more thankful and honored to have you guys as guests today. Again, thank you so much. But that's going to be all that we have for you guys tonight. I thank you guys, whoever's watching, listening out here, for coming and joining us today. I hope all of your stacks are fat and stay hydrated, and we will see you all next time.
Hang on this all day.